premature babies died when Israeli forces cut the power to their incubators. Medics, journalists were targeted. The regime's senior officials openly called to starve an entire people. Children shot by snipers while eating. Mothers stopped producing milk because they themselves were starving. Over 67,000 people killed within 2 years at the hands of the occupation regime. And through it all, through every bombing, every massacre, one country never wavered in its support: the United States of America. I'm Roya Poubar, and this is True Promise.
While AIPAC is often seen as a powerhouse of Zionist lobby in Washington, it's Christian Zionists, far larger number, who form a backbone of unconditional U.S. support for Israel. Christians United for Israel, the movement's flagship group, boasts more than 10 million members. But the real number of Americans who share its ideology is likely much higher.
Who defend the anti-Semitic chants of "from the river to the sea." It is time for you to resign so we can finally dispose of your Jew hatred on the ash heap of history.
Christian Zionism fuses faith with politics. It teaches that Israel's creation in 1948, its occupation of Palestinian land, and continued legal settlement are all part of a divine plan leading to Jesus' return. Rooted in 16th century Protestant interpretations of biblical prophecy, the movement sees the so-called Jew control of the Holy Land as a necessary prelude to the Second Coming. Supporting Israel in this theology isn't just politics, it's prophecy.
Hello, I'm Pastor John Hagee, the founder and national chairman of Christians United for Israel, also known as KUFA. Over 40 years ago, my wife Diana and I felt the Lord's direction to create a night to honor Israel, an event that would bring Christians and Jews together in an atmosphere of honoring the Jewish people for their contributions to Christianity. Today, CUFI is the foremost pro-Israel grassroots movement dedicated to educating, motivating, and empowering millions of Americans to speak and act with one voice in defense of Israel and the Jewish people.
But there's a darker edge. Christian Zionists' ultimate goal isn't Jewish salvation, it's their own. They envision an apocalyptic end time in which non-believers perish, while true Christians ascend to heaven. Their backing of Israel, then, is less about solidarity and more about self-interest dressed in scripture. Still, their ideology aligns neatly with Israel's right-wing cabinets and their aggressive policies toward Palestinians and the resistance axis. Christian Zionism's influence in U.S. politics exploded in the 1980s. Televangelists Jerry Falwell and Pat Robertson, pillars of the moral majority, forged direct ties with Israeli leaders and brought millions of evangelical voters into the Republican fold. Under Ronald Reagan, biblical Armageddon shaped not just rhetoric, but policy, with top officials reportedly praying for the world's end. By the early 2000s, Falwell's movement had become the Republican Party's largest voting bloc, deeply entwined with pro-Israel causes. Christian Zionist lobbying even helped overturn a 1975 UN resolution equating Zionism with racism, a remarkable diplomatic reversal achieved after years of coordinated pressure from groups like the National Christian Leadership Conference for Israel. Their influence only grew under George W. Bush. Evangelical leaders opposed every step toward a Palestinian state, and their grassroots campaigns, like one that sent 50,000 protest postcards to the White House, succeeded in derailing peace efforts, such as a 2003 roadmap. By the Trump's first 4 years in the White House, Christian Zionism wasn't just influential, it was in power. Figures like Mike Pence, Mike Pompeo, and Steve Bannon openly embraced this worldview. The administration moved the U.S. Embassy to Al-Quds, endorsed West Bank settlements, tore up the Iran nuclear deal, and unveiled a peace plan that erased Palestinian sovereignty. Behind it all was a fusion of Christian end times theology, Zionist politics, and white nationalist ideology. Meanwhile, the Trump-era crackdown on Palestinian activism continued under Biden, whose administration failed to reverse measures like the State Department's adoption of the IHRA definition of anti-Semitism, a tool often used to silence criticism. criticism of Israel. And now Trump is back to back the Israeli regime with no strings attached. The enduring alliance between Christian Zionism and U.S. power reveals a dangerous paradox. A movement that claims divine purpose but thrives on domination, casting colonialism as prophecy and injustice as fate.
We're now joined in the studio by Dr. Elham Katfodai, a leading scholar and professor of the history of Zionism at the Faculty of World Studies in Tehran University. Thank you so much for joining us. Well, to start, could you help us understand why many evangelical Christians view regional wars as part of the end of times, and how does this translate into practical support for such wars?
So this belief is part of what they call dispensationalism, in which history is divided into different segments, and the final one in which we have the final emergence of the Savior, of the, or the coming back of Jesus Christ, is an era in which, according to biblical prophecy, Jews should be living in and having a state in the Holy Land. So that's why this is very important for a big segment of these evangelicals. We should bear in mind that not all evangelicals are Christian Zionists. There's a large population of evangelicals in the United States. There are some in other countries as well, but not all of them share in this kind of end of times belief system. But for those of them who do believe in this turn of events, this particular issue has become very important. So the fact that Jews have a right and they should be living in and having a state inside Palestine is something that they should necessitate. They should do whatever they can to help this happen.
Mm-hmm. And that's why they would regard supporting such wars as...
It's not just politics for them, it's a part of their belief system.
Right.
Because it's part of God's will. God has willed this to happen. It's his plan for history, so that's why we should be doing all we can to make
support
this happen.
Support this movement,
yes.
And let it lead to that.
Yes.
Well, beyond just being a matter of personal belief, has this worldview of theirs shaped or, let's say, redirected Washington's policies?
Mm-hmm. Well, these so-called Christian Zionists have very specific institutions where they come together and they get united behind a specific type of policy led by individuals who are very effective leaders. So it's not just individual Christians living in different states and having their own belief. It's actually influential institutions that act in a way as a kind of pro-Israel lobby inside the United States. So when we talk about the Israeli lobby in the U.S., what we usually have in mind is AIPAC, J Street, these types of lobby groups, which are Jewish American. But these Christian groups also, like, for example, Christians United for Israel, these are the members and the leaders are Christians, but they also have this very firm belief in their duty and their obligation to influence policy. And that's very important because the United States is basically the most important and effective backer of Zionism and of the most important supporter of Israel. So that's very significant. Mm-hmm. Leading the United States into a kind of a unquestioned support for whatever the Israeli government does, and not just whatever, but the most right-wing, radical policy that Israeli politicians, because we know that Israeli politicians themselves have kind of different ideological beliefs. But the most right wing of them, what they say and what they want to enact, like, for example, the issue of the settlements, moving of the embassy to Jerusalem, these types of policies are things and policies that these groups advocate.
Right. For deeper insight, we sat down with Dr. Sayed Haji Burhani, assistant professor at the University of Tehran. A specialist in Palestinian studies, Dr. Burhani earned his PhD from the University of Exeter's European Center for Palestine Studies, and has published widely, including in the Journal of Holy Land and Palestine Studies.
In the United States, the number of Christian Zionists has increased compared to the past, and they now make up a significant portion of the voting population. Therefore, one of the key ways to influence U.S. policy is through the ballot box and elections. In American politics, this influence is primarily seen in two major elections, congressional elections and presidential elections. The reality is that if candidates can win the support of Christian Zionists, whether in presidential or congressional elections, they will be in a much stronger position to win. A clear example is Trump's victory, in which Christian Zionists played a significant role by participating in the election and voting for him. There are numerous instances in U.S. foreign policy where the American government or the president has taken actions or adopted policies under the influence of Christian Zionists. This group places special emphasis on Al-Quds, or as they call it, Jerusalem, as well as Israel, because they believe that the second and final coming of Jesus Christ will take place in the land of Israel and in Al-Quds, and that this will only happen when the Jews have full control over the area. Therefore, they strongly support Israel's complete dominance over Palestinian territories and want Al-Quds to be recognized as the capital of Israel. They view this as a necessary prelude to the second coming of Christ, and they support any action that reinforces or solidifies this belief. One of the key demands of Christian Zionists was for Al-Quds to be declared the capital of Israel and for the United States to officially recognize it. As you saw, this is exactly what happened during Donald Trump's first term as president, when he moved the U.S. Embassy to Al-Quds, an action that fulfilled a major goal of the Christian Zionist movement. Another issue is the Golan Heights, a territory considered occupied under international law and United Nations resolutions. During Trump's first term, the United States officially recognized the annexation of the Golan Heights by Israel. In effect, the U.S. accepted that Israel had formally incorporated this region into its territory.
Thank you for recognizing Israeli sovereignty over the Golan Heights.
Israelis and Jews have a dual perspective toward Christian Zionists. On one hand, they welcome their support because it is extremely strong, perhaps the most unwavering support Israel receives anywhere in the world. The main reason for this support is that it stems from a rigid and dogmatic religious belief, one that is unaffected by political considerations. It is rooted in a conviction that the conditions must be prepared for the return of Jesus Christ, and that this return will only happen when Jews have full control over the land of Palestine.
The word Armageddon is actually two words, Har Megiddo, or Hill of Megiddo. You are standing on the Hill of Megiddo right now. The final act of the book of Revelation is going to begin right here at this place.
Christian Zionists are in fact deeply devout Christians who are strongly committed to their faith and seek to convert everyone in the world, especially Jews, to Christianity. According to the narratives they reference, when Jews gain control over the land of Palestine and Jesus Christ returns, they will be given an ultimatum that they must convert to Christianity, and if they refuse, they will be massacred. This presents a contradiction. Jews say that while Christian Zionists support them, they do not actually accept Jewish beliefs and are ultimately aiming to eliminate Judaism. Therefore, it is said that the support of Christian Zionists for Israel is temporary and fragile, and in reality, it does not align with the true interests of the Jewish people. They view Israel as a tool to fulfill their own religious prophecies. The reality is that a major shift is taking place among evangelical Christians. Within the younger evangelical community, significant doubt and hesitation have emerged regarding support for Israel. Today, the younger generation, those under 30, for example, is rapidly withdrawing its support for Israel. Older generations have remained somewhat loyal, but after October 7th and Israel's attack on Gaza, along with the atrocities committed there, public opinion in Western countries, especially among the youth, has been deeply affected. Now we see that young people in Western countries, wherever gatherings take place, whether in stadiums, concerts, or universities, are chanting against Israel, expressing support for Palestinians, and voicing outrage over the crimes in Gaza. The truth is that young Christian Zionists and evangelicals have also been strongly influenced by this atmosphere, and signs are beginning to appear that the previous level of support no longer exists. It is predicted that if this trend continues, evangelical support for Israel will gradually weaken and may eventually collapse entirely.
I understand that they have this belief and they see all of this as the end of times and something they should move forward to, mm-hmm. but how do they, on the other hand, how do evangelicals justify the humanitarian crises in Gaza, in Lebanon?
It's part of God's plan. So it's, you know, when you give something a kind of a very otherworldly kind of an mm-hmm. explanation or philosophy, and it's, you know, humans are sometimes selective in which part of reality they want to focus on, which part they want to believe in. So it's always, you know, God gave this land to the Jewish people. So it's theirs. They have a very kind of a firm right. Mm-hmm. And anyone who's questioning this, whether in a kind of a political or military or whatever kind of a questioning of this Jewish right to the Holy Land, that person is in the wrong. So it was Hamas's fault. It's the Palestinians' fault. They're getting in the way of God's plan. Mm-hmm. But also I have to mention this, that when we talk about American Christian Zionists or evangelicals, it's not something that's, you know, it's not something that's engraved in stone. These people and their ideas have changed throughout time, and it will change as well. So we really don't know what the final impact of this 2-year war on Gaza would be on individual human beings who categorize themselves as Christian Zionists. Mm-hmm. For many of them, this might, you know, make them change how they view things, because even before the 7th of October attack, there were some polls indicating that among the younger generation of evangelical Christians, support for Israel was in decline. By in decline, I don't mean that they just put aside supporting Israel and, you know, they overwhelmingly, for example, support Palestine, but there was a gradual decline, meaning that younger people, younger generations, were starting to think a bit differently, starting to think about justice as well as this issue of, you know, this theological kind of a framework to see what's happening in the Middle East. They were moving towards including justice in their ultimate judgment of what's happening. Mm-hmm. And I believe that, well, the 7th of October attack, the Al-Aqsa flood operation, the 2-year war in Gaza will lead a lot of people into thinking more critically about this issue. I don't know if there is any call yet on this or not, but, you know, this generational gap was forming before all of this happened. Mm-hmm. So we have to bear this in mind as well, that things are not fixed and they might change.
They're always changing. And Yes. Of course, during these 2 years, the Israeli atrocities are bound to have an effect on mm-hmm. this generation and their, and, you know, changing opinions and outlook towards Israel and what's happening with occupied Palestine. And, well, I want to turn to the role of Christian Zionists in U.S. politics. Mm-hmm. How did they manage to inject their worldview into U.S. foreign policy?
By organizing, mm-hmm. by advocating, by coming together, as I said, having influential leaders that lead people into you know, amassing their energy into making, you know, having some effect on the country's actual policy. So it's important to note that some of these groups, like, if I'm not mistaken, Christians United for Israel, the total number of the members are larger than the whole number of Jews living inside America.
Oh, wow.
So that's how influential in terms of, for example, voting. And there, because we often talk about the Jewish vote, for example, and how influential it is. But for years before all of these events in the Middle East happened, Netanyahu and many Israeli politicians have been gradually turning their attention from American Jews to Christian Zionists, because they believe that these people are would be more beneficial for them. An interesting fact about American Jews is that a big part of them are kind of, you know, they have left-wing liberal ideas which might be very different to the right-wing policies of Netanyahu. That doesn't mean that they are totally critical of Israel, but that they do allow for criticism towards Israel. But Christian Zionists, on the other hand, because they believe that everything is part of God's plan for this land, they usually do not criticize controversial Israeli policies, like, for example, expanding the settlements in the West Bank,
right.
Yeah, or even annexing the West Bank. So that's why these people have become a more reliable ally for Israel
that's
within
right.
the United States. Yes. So, as I said, part of it is their organization, the way they vote. Many of the policies that Trump has chosen to move forward with, not just in this his most recent term, but also in the previous term, for example, moving the embassy to Jerusalem, were partially to satisfy his Christian Zionist voters.
On the anniversary of Operation Al-Aqsa Flood, the Palestine Museum in Tehran opened Symphony of Crime, a powerful exhibition of resistance art. 15 artists presented more than 30 cartoons portraying the violence and suffering inflicted under Zionist occupation. Our team visited the gallery to witness how art becomes a voice of defiance and remembrance.
This exhibition was organized around the events of October 7th, the Palestinian operation on that day. Our perspective was that from within this event, from within this unfolding movement, an awakening should emerge, and thankfully it has. We still want to be part of that path and contribute as artists and as caricature artists. The difference between a caricature artist and other types of artists is that the content is produced very quickly, and a message conveyed doesn't require subtitles or translation. It connects easily with all audiences. That means you could present this same exhibition in another country, in any language, without any changes, and people of all ages, backgrounds, and perspectives would still be able to engage with it and understand the message. Our aim has been to provoke thought, raise awareness, and awaken society so that people realize a horrific event is happening in Gaza, a genocide, a massacre of children. People should not remain silent or indifferent. They must take action and make an impact. Our work may be a small step toward preventing this tragedy, and we hope can be meaningful.
The subjects I've worked on are not merely recounting events, they are analyses of those events. One of the key aspects of caricature is that we don't just inform the audience, we offer analysis. Sometimes we even present arguments to explain why what has happened should be considered a crime or an act of occupation. Why is this action fundamentally problematic? We clarify these points. Two of my works currently on display in the exhibition reflect this approach. One features an image of an octopus with a cylindrical hat and smoking a cigar, symbolizing colonialism and oppressive power structures. The goal of this piece is to draw public attention to a broader issue and to say our concern isn't just here. At one time, South Africa was occupied, a revolution occurred, and that occupation ended. After that came the issue of Palestine. Before all of that, Native Americans in the Americas were subjected to genocide and their populations were wiped out. There are examples of struggles that succeeded and others that were defeated, like South Africa and Palestine, which is still in the middle of its path. We must understand that the issue should not be framed in terms of ethnicity or tied to a specific religion, nor should it be turned into a confrontation. We must focus on the root of colonialism, and that must be dismantled.
The 35 works presented here are all in the form of caricatures, theme-driven caricatures forming a symphony of crime. Our subject is the same, the killing of children and the crimes committed by Israel, particularly focusing on the figure of Netanyahu in the context of Gaza.
That is the central theme. And the common thread among all the works is the spirit of the resistance front and the shared concern for such events. Some individuals, media outlets, or public figures may not feel a sense of urgency about this issue. But what unites all the artists in this exhibition is their concern for addressing this tragedy within society. Art can undoubtedly carry the voice of the oppressed people of Palestine to the entire world, and not just convey it, but also solidify it. A powerful work of art can endure over time, remain in people's minds, become a symbol, turn into a cultural reference, and circulate widely, continuously reused and reinterpreted.
Even before Israel's bombing campaign against Iran began, Christian Zionist leaders were calling for escalation, framing war as prophecy in motion. When the strike started, they didn't mourn the devastation, they rejoiced in it. Mike Huckabee, longtime evangelical ally of Donald Trump and now U.S. ambassador to Israel, declared online that Trump had been spared from assassination to fulfill God's plan in West Asia. And now with Israel's assault on Iran, that theology finds its battlefield. For Christian Zionists, the bombing of Tehran or Isfahan isn't a geopolitical crisis. It's a signpost on the road to revelation. Civilian casualties, regional chaos, nuclear brinkmanship all become proof that the end is near and therefore divinely ordained. What the rest of the world sees as a humanitarian disaster, they see as destiny. The danger isn't just the war on Iran, it's the belief that such a war is holy.
Life is full of choices. Choose the best option. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
Tawakkul comes from the root word wakala. Wakala means...
Today, I'd like to read to you an excerpt from...
Allah is the unique Arabic name.
Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has decreed.
His decree, though...
This is Foresight, a program on how to worship Allah. Today's great tip, the role that the pleasure of Allah has upon our ubudiyah, our worship, our servitude, and our obedience to Allah. Welcome back, dear listeners. This is Foresight on IRIB English Radio. So we are talking about the role that the pleasure of Allah, the satisfaction of Allah, plays in our ubudiyah, our worship, our servitude, and our obedience to Allah. So dear friends, just as heavenly bodies and the earth always have a fixed axis through which they make diverse rotations and revolutions all across the universe, worship and ubudiyah and the servitude and the obedience to the Almighty Allah, with all of its various forms and appearances, is also anchored upon a fixed axis. And this axis, this pivot, is the pleasure of the Almighty Allah. It is the satisfaction of the Almighty Allah. So this is something that is incredibly important. We find that we do a lot of different kinds of worship throughout our daily life and throughout our whole life. This worship, this obedience, this servitude to the Almighty Allah, of course, needs to have this very fundamental motivator, or something that helps us to continuously stay and remain in this state of ubudiyah. Now, that thing which is the fundamental motivator is that we want to attain the pleasure of the Almighty Allah, the satisfaction of the Almighty Allah. And so the more that we want to make the Almighty Allah happy with us, we want to make the Almighty Allah satisfied with us, this rida or ridayat or radhi, there are all these different forms of the word of being satisfied or to satisfy the Almighty Allah. The more we do that, of course, the higher our rank becomes as a abid, as a worshiper, as one who is obedient to the Almighty Allah. And it's really a very beautiful motivator indeed, because it is based upon this love for the Almighty Allah, this profound ishq of the Almighty Allah. And it is this ishq of the Almighty Allah which makes one want to satisfy the Almighty Allah and to seek the pleasure and the satisfaction of the Almighty Allah. And what's really beautiful is that when we attain the pleasure and the satisfaction and the acceptance of the Almighty Allah, then we too will feel a sense of fulfillment and satisfaction. IRIB English Radio. Please follow our radio programs and podcasts on iranradio.ir. Now we invite you to listen to Sheikh Ja'far Ja'far.
When we look at ahadith, we find again tawakkul is one of the most important characteristics that were given to the Prophet. This is a very beautiful hadith. For those who have the book Sunan al-Nabi, in Sunan al-Nabi, when it one of the chapters describes the characteristics of the Prophet. So Sunan al-Nabi describes the Prophet very beautifully, one of the best books which describes the Prophet. So it describes the characteristics of the Prophet. In the chapter that describes the characteristics of the Prophet, I forget the hadith number, but I think it's something around 36 or so. It has a very lengthy hadith in which Jibreel alayhi salam comes down to Prophet Muhammad and he says that I have come bearing gifts for you, O Prophet of God. So he says, what are these gifts that you have come bearing for me? He says, the first gift that we have for you is patience. But then he said, we have something better than patience. The Prophet says, what is better than patience? He says, I'm bringing you the gift of rida, satisfaction. But Allah has given you something greater than satisfaction. So the Prophet says, what can be greater than satisfaction? So he says, az-zuhud, asceticism, and something better than asceticism. So the Prophet says, what can be better than zuhud? He says that Allah has sent you ikhlas, sincerity. And then the Prophet says, what can be better than ikhlas? He says, he sent you yaqeen, certainty in him. He says, but he has sent you something better than yaqeen. And the Prophet says, what can be better than yaqeen? He says, he has sent you tawakkul. He has sent you the trust in Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, to be able to rely upon God. Now the reason for mentioning Sunan al-Nabi is the Prophet then asks the angel to describe each one of these things for him. He says, describe to me tawakkul, describe for me zuhud, describe for me yaqeen. And in that book, there's this very lengthy hadith, but Angel Jibreel describes each one of these characteristics in a very beautiful manner. I'm only going to touch upon tawakkul. So after the Prophet, after Jibreel alayhi salam says to the Prophet, peace and blessings be upon him and his family, that Allah has given you tawakkul. And this is where it ends. He doesn't say after tawakkul there is something better than tawakkul. So in the end result, tawakkul is that top gift that he had been given. So the Prophet says to him, okay, what is tawakkul? So the angel describes, he says, Al-ilmu bi-anna al-makhluqa la yadurru wa la yanfa'u wa la yu'ti wa la yamna'u. He says, tawakkul is the knowledge that the creation of God cannot harm you, nor can they benefit you. Okay? This is very beautiful hadith. Okay? If you can stay with me, it would be great. He says, بِأَنَّ الْمَخْلُوقَ لَا يَضُرُّ وَلَا يَنْفَعُ. He says, it is the knowledge that the creation of God cannot benefit you, nor can they harm you. وَلَا يُعْطِي وَلَا يَمْنَعُ. Nor can they deny you anything, nor can they provide you anything. It is the knowledge that the creation of God cannot harm you or benefit you or deny you or give you anything. وَالْإِسْتِعْمَالُ الْيَأْسِ مِنْ خَلْقِ. And it is to have complete despair in the creation of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. That they cannot do anything to you, and in fact almost to the extent where you don't need anything from them. So this is how he describes tawakkul, but it continues. فَإِذَا كَانَ الْعَبْدُ كَذَلِكَ. He says, if a servant of God can think in this manner, that the creation of God cannot harm me or benefit me, and I don't need anything from them. لِأَحَدٍ سِوَى اللَّهِ. If he can think of this and believe this about everyone except for God. وَلَمْ يَرْجُوا وَلَمْ يَخَفْ سِوَى اللَّهِ. And does not hope in, nor does he fear in anyone except for God. وَلَمْ يَطْمَعَ فِي أَحَدٍ سِوَى اللَّهِ. And is not satisfied with anyone except for Allah. This is tawakkul, he says to him. فَهَذَا tawakkul.
Welcome back, dear listeners. So we were talking about the role of the pleasure of the Almighty Allah when it comes to our ubudiyah, our worship, our servitude, and our obedience to the Almighty Allah. So this satisfaction of the Almighty Allah, we had said in the previous segment that the satisfaction of the Almighty Allah, seeking the pleasure of the Almighty Allah, seeking the acceptance of the Almighty Allah, these are all things that are motivators. It motivates an individual to be able to engage in deeper and higher levels of ubudiyah, in deeper and higher levels of worship and obedience and servitude to the Almighty Allah. Now, the higher that this satisfaction and this contentment and this pleasure of the Almighty Allah reaches, of course, the higher levels are really things that are, I don't know, unimaginable. The purer that the worship becomes, the purer that the obedience becomes, the more pure that the servitude becomes, the higher levels of Allah's satisfaction are attained. So it's really interesting, for example, the eighth divinely appointed imam, his nickname or his title is Ar-Ridha. one who is satisfied or one who is content. And so this is, you know, the contentment with what the Almighty Allah has ordained and decreed. You know, in one of these phrases, when it comes to Imam Hussein alayhi salam, we say Razi bil qadri wa qaza, meaning that they are satisfied with the destiny and the fate that has been ordained to a certain extent by the Almighty Allah. But when it comes to the satisfaction of the Almighty Allah, it comes to attaining the pleasure of the Almighty Allah. This is a fundamental axis around which ubudiyah revolves. And so without this wanting to seek the satisfaction of the Almighty Allah, you know, the worship and the obedience and the servitude and the ubudiyah in general begins to become watered down.
Dear listeners of the program Foresight, my name is Muhammad. Today, I'd like to read to you an excerpt from Munajatul Khaifin, the Whispered Prayer of the Fearful. Please stay with me. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, my God, lock not toward those who profess your unity the doors of your mercy, and veil not those which you has exalted by its professing your unity. How will you burn it in the heat of your fires? My God, a heart which has been knotted by its love for you, how will you burn it in the heat of your fires? My God, give me sanctuary from your painful wrath and your mighty anger. O all-loving, O all-kind, O compassionate, O merciful, O compeller, O subduer, O all-forgiver, O all-covering, deliver me for your mercy from the chastisement of the fire and the disgrace of shame, when the good are set apart from the evil, forms are transformed, terrors terrify, the good doers are brought near, the evil doers taken far, and every soul is paid in full what it has earned, and they shall not be wronged.
Thank you very much for listening to this episode of the program, Foresight. For more information, visit our website at iranradio.ir. Until another episode, God bless you and fi amanillah. Thank you.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Ruba Shavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Poreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian Administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
During a meeting with Russian President Vladimir Putin in the Kremlin, Syria's self-proclaimed president and the leader of the transitional government, Ahmed al-Shara, assured that Damascus intends to take steps on resuming comprehensive cooperation with the Russian Federation. He emphasized the critical importance of maintaining stability in the region. Referring to bilateral ties, he said Moscow should see it through a new Syria. The Russian leader, for his part, noted that special relations between Damascus and Moscow developed decades ago. President Putin emphasized that Syria and Russia have a unique relationship that has grown over the course of 80 years, having been formed in the midst of Russia's and the Soviet Union's most trying circumstances in late 1944. Throughout the decades, the two have maintained a close relationship. He also expressed hope that the recent parliamentary elections in Syria will lead to the consolidation of society and will contribute to the further strengthening of ties between the country's political forces. Experts believe that Russia and Syria have many joint initiatives that Moscow is ready to develop.
Jilani's assertion that the new Syria abides by all early agreements struck between Moscow and Damascus encapsulates the conclusion of this discussion in the Kremlin. Russia still has two military bases, large investments in Syria and other intentions, the execution of which is still uncertain. Marina Kartunova, Moscow.
Despite the ceasefire agreement reached between Hamas and Israel last week, the regime's forces have killed more Palestinians and imposed new restrictions on humanitarian aid entering Gaza. The Rafah crossing, a critical lifeline for supplies and medical evacuations, remains closed, contrary to earlier commitments. Aid deliveries have also slowed dramatically. Truck drivers report long delays and extensive inspections. According to the United Nations, Israel is allowing only 300 aid trucks into Gaza daily. That's half the amount agreed upon. The UN has urged all parties to uphold their commitments and facilitate humanitarian access.
We certainly want as much aid as possible to go in. And like I said, we're asking all the parties to adhere to their agreements.
Under the deal, Hamas agreed to release all remaining Israeli captives, both living and deceased, in exchange for the release of approximately 2,000 Palestinian prisoners. While Israeli officials accuse Hamas of violating the agreement over the return of captives' bodies, the group insists it has fulfilled its obligations, citing the need for special equipment to retrieve bodies buried under the rubble. Even U.S. President Donald Trump, Israel's closest ally, has downplayed the claim, describing the search for the remains of Israeli captives in Gaza as a gruesome process.
So we have the living hostages all back. They returned some more today. It's a gruesome process. I almost hate to talk about it. But they're digging. They're actually digging. There are areas where they're digging and they're finding a lot of bodies.
This says Israel has yet to approve the entry of heavy machinery needed for removing 70 million tons of rubble from the war, further complicating recovery efforts. Beyond Gaza, Israeli forces and settlers still raid areas across the occupied West Bank, including attacks on olive harvesters and farmland. In Lebanon, ceasefire violations persist, with Israeli strikes targeting southern regions. As the Israeli regime appears to be falling short of its obligations in the region, the future of the Gaza ceasefire remains precarious. Observers warn that without accountability and full access for aid agencies, the truce faces a serious risk.
At the University of Paris 8 in Saint-Denis, teachers, students, and activists gathered for a roundtable titled, After 2 Years of Genocide, What Future Remains for Palestinians? The organizers called for continued political and grassroots mobilization until colonization ends. The conference, organized by Revolution Permanente Euro-Palestine and the Student Union Federation, featured speakers from various backgrounds.
some of whom recently returned flotilla, which was intercepted by occupation forces. They all agreed that the humanitarian situation remains catastrophic and that the political struggle must continue. Speakers and attendees stressed the need for continued engagement, both within imperialist countries that support the occupation and across the Arab world, where governments are accused of relaying colonial policies. Many also spoke about the repression faced by activists on the ground and at sea. The Paris 8 roundtable ended with a unified message. Do not settle for fragile agreements or temporary promises. Continue political, legal, and popular mobilization until colonization ends. For the organizers, Revolution Permanente, Euro-Palestine, and the Student Union Federation, the goal is clear: to strengthen international solidarity and intensify actions to achieve the liberation of the Palestinian people and the restoration of their fundamental rights. Kasim Hassan, Paris.
Palestinian prisoner Saeed Toubassi from Jenin refugee camp has spent over 20 years behind bars, serving 31 life sentences and 50 additional years. His family had long awaited his release, hoping the current ceasefire deal would finally bring him home. Instead, his mother was left devastated after learning that his name was not included.
I really thought this time he would come home. I had so much hope. We all did. We were ready to welcome him after so many years. Saeed was imprisoned when he was just a young man, and now most of his life has passed behind bars. He is ill and needs medical treatment. I just want to see him free before I die.
Yaqub El Qadri, sentenced to 2 life terms and 35 years in jail, is one of the 6 Palestinian prisoners who escaped through the Freedom Tunnel from Jalbour prison in 2021. He was recaptured days later for his story being a symbol of resistance and endurance. His family, who have already lost their parents, had hoped this deal would reunite them, but the news brought only renewed heartbreak.
We stayed up all night, hoping his name would be on the list. We had so much hope, because he was one of the heroes of the Freedom Tunnel operation. All the others were free, and we believed he would be too. But he stayed behind. His health is fragile. He suffers from thyroid cancer and multiple bone fractures, and he has been in prison since 2021. It's heartbreaking to know he's still locked in his cell while we wait for justice.
For others, the pain is even much higher, as the name of their loved one was in the list, but removed later.
We came back from abroad to welcome my brother. We had prepared everything for his release and were full of hope, as his name was in the list. But when the final decision came, he was not released. The disappointment was heartbreaking. We had imagined this moment for so long, but it didn't come.
Ma'amar Sabah is serving 23 years in Israeli prison. He is among thousands who are waiting for their freedom from Israeli jail notorious for mistreatment of inmates.
In the occupied Palestinian territories, joy never overcomes the pain, especially for the families of those who have been held illegally by the Israeli regime. They waited with hope to see their loved ones walk free. But once again, the occupying regime turned their happiness into heartbreak. Tibas, occupied Jenin.
On Tuesday, about 10,000 people took to the streets of Italy's northeastern city of Udine in support of the besieged Palestinians and calling for Israel's ban from international sport ahead of the FIFA World Cup qualifier between the Italian and the Israeli national teams. Extraordinary security measures were in place in Udine, including snipers on the roof of the Israel team hotel. Clashes erupted between Italian police and about 50 anti-Israel protesters who were sprayed with water cannons.
We have taken the streets against the match of shame, but also to create awareness about the Zionist criminal plan of Great Israel. Israel won't stop until it achieves it.
A pro-Palestine protest was also held in the Italian capital Rome, where about 1,000 people gathered in solidarity with the Gazans. simultaneously with the Italy-Israel FIFA qualifier, a friendly match involving Palestinian refugees and some Italian actors and musicians was played in front of a cheering crowd.
Some people here at the protest speculated on the reasons why FIFA President Gianni Infantino was photographed next to the United States President Donald Trump at the Gaza ceasefire summit held in Sharm el-Sheikh on Monday. Earlier this month, Infantino brushed aside calls for Israel's suspension from international football by indirectly addressing it as a geopolitical issue.
We must spell out the facts. Our government, the media, some sporting institutions are in the hands of Zionism, which bankrolls their activities in different ways. That's why FIFA doesn't exclude Israel from all competitions.
I'm from Southfleet, between Nablus and Ramallah, in the West Bank. I play as a goalkeeper. Several Palestinian famous football players have been killed following the Israeli genocidal operations in Gaza.
For the record, Italy defeated Israel 3-0 in the FIFA World Cup qualifier. Max Civili, Rome.
Pioneering actor Mohammad Kassabi has passed away, taking his remarkable deeds with him and leaving behind a legacy spanning over half a century. And here at the Islamic Thought and Art Center, Ibanians have gathered to honor and celebrate the lasting contributions of this veteran actor, director, and cultural visionary.
His role in the movie Good Rider deeply affected me. I very much liked his chivalry and how he was a real man of the people.
There was an hour-long drama in which he was the only actor